Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Friday, January 15th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Let's take a look at the front page and the very top of the page, the main story, Businesses Reap Grants. This is reported by Bennett Goldstein and it's from Platteville. A Dickeyville Trucking Company, Cubis City Insurance Brokerage, Hazel Green Woodworker, and Platteville Dry Cleaner are among 1,381 small businesses in the southwest corner of Wisconsin that receive state grants to help them ride out the pandemic. Data recently released by the Wisconsin Department of Revenue indicates that business owners in Crawford, Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties received nearly $5.2 million in federal COVID-19 related funding dispersed by the state in 2020. We had to be shut down for 3 months, said Adam Gillette, co-owner of The Hive, a Platteville CBD retailer. We lost a lot of sales there while we were still paying the rent. He and his business partners, Louis Rivera III and Vance Selvey, applied for a We're All In grant, which provided the company with $5,000. It helped cover for lost sales for a little bit and put us in a situation where we would have a little bit more money to try to expand our website and reach out to more wholesalers, Gillette said. The program, created by Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, dispersed dollars authorized under the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act to help businesses following mandated shutdowns from March through late May. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers allocated $240 million to the program. Grants for small and medium-sized businesses range from $2,500 to $20,000. Abby Haas, Lafayette County Economic Development Director, said many business owners lacking employees turned to the state program after learning they did not qualify for the federal Paycheck Protection Program. It's great support to have, she said. It allowed them to get by during the shutdowns, but it's not going to make up for lost revenue. The shutdowns were especially detrimental to businesses because they occurred during the late spring and summer, normally a time where they save money to ride out the slower post-Christmas winter season, said Cuba City Economic Development Director Bob Jones. Last summer, they didn't have those kinds of numbers, said Jones, who reached out to local businesses to encourage them to apply for state grants. Financially and psychologically, I think it is a great help. It's nice for the businesses to know that the government cares about them, but we also worry how the government is going to pay for this. Potosi Brewing Company received $20,000, which helped cover operating expenses, said David Fritz, president of Potosi Foundation, which owns the on-site brewery, restaurant, and museum. Our business was down significantly as a result of the pandemic, and we want to make sure we are not only able to continue to operate now, but also go back to full service and full occupancy, he said. While many restaurants offered curbside pickup options for would-be diners during the shutdown, the strategy was less successful for the brewery because most patrons are tourists, he said. Major fundraising events also were canceled. The application process was very simple, very straightforward, and welcomed, Fritz said. The article is accompanied by a picture taken by Dave Kettering of the Herald, Telegraph Herald, and the caption says, Caitlin Grich tends to the bar inside the Potosi Brewing Company in Potosi on Wednesday. The brewery received a grant, a state grant funded by the Federal CARES Act, and there are also individual pictures of those mentioned in the article, Adam Guillette and David Fritz. On the left side of the front page, the story reported by Kaylee Reese of Telegraph Herald. It says, the headline, Little Food Pantries Offer Welcome Relief. An anonymous note excerpted in italics in this article recently was found inside a local little food pantry. To Andy Spaniel, who helps run the Little Food Pantry at Lord of Life Lutheran Church in Asbury, Iowa, the note underscored the importance of the free food resource. We just think it's horrible, Spaniel said of the note. which recently was shared on Facebook, I was just crying. The church's little food pantry is one of several across Dubuque County. These pantries are available at all hours and operate under a take what you need, leave what you can motto. Spaniel said a group of church volunteers restocks the mini pantry daily during the cold months of the COVID-19 pandemic. Most people come under the cover of night to take needed items, she added. It's mainly that people are ashamed to come to food pantries and are scared to ask for help, she said. These are people that could be my neighbor, they could be your neighbor, that always provided food for their family, but they don't qualify for SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or whatever other programs there are. I have always provided for my family, that was before. Now my pay is cut in half, and I can't afford to pay the mortgage, and I don't have the skills I need for this kind of hunting. Spaniel has been trying to track the location of Little Food Pantries on the Dubuque Little Food Pantries Facebook page so she can add them to a global map of Little Pantry locations. However, she said, confirming the locations can be difficult. She often drives to reported locations without finding a pantry. There is a confirmed Little Pantry at Holy Trinity Lutheran Church, 1755 Delhi Street. The Reverend Derek Rosensteel said the church has had one for several years, with items available both inside and outside the church. He added that St. Paul Lutheran Church on Asbury Road recently built a little food pantry in a similar style to the Holy Trinity one. You can stock it at 8 in the morning, and by 2 it's empty, he said. Those shelves really do serve a need and a purpose. There's another quote, "We make too much to qualify for government benefits, and the stimulus payment only goes so far. I don't want the neighbors to know I'm failing. On this night, my heart is as dark as the sky. I make my way to the magic box of love to gather food to supplement our cupboards." Another confirmed little food pantry location is in the yard of Danielle Nyans at 1991 Golden Eagle Drive. She said she wanted to run a little pantry for a while, but during the early weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic, she organized a group of neighborhood volunteers to build one. She and other neighbors restocked the pantry, which is her 3-year-old son Hudson's favorite chore. She said it feels good to know he's helping others, even if it's just by contributing a little, a simple but necessary item. "I think a lot of the food programs help people if they're financially qualified, but maybe you make good money but fell on hard times," Nyan said of who benefits from the pantries. "On record, it might look like you have enough money, but you may be struggling right now." And here's another quote. "I have to figure out how to get something high sugar for my diabetic loved one. This isn't a treat. If his glucose goes low, he could die without something high in sugar, like juice or hard candy or syrup." While not on the confirmed little food pantry map, two can be found in the Washington neighborhood in Dubuque. Heidi Zull, site supervisor at Multicultural Family Center, said there is one on East 14th Street in an alleyway between Jackson and Jefferson and Washington Streets, and another at East 18th and Washington Streets. The one on East 14th was built by a couple who lived there, she said. The 18th and Washington one began as a produce stand for extra items grown in the community garden, but this year it was solidified as a little pantry due to COVID-19 and the high need for food. "I think a lot of people did not expect to be impacted by COVID-19, she said. "It's really important to have these sort of places that don't have any barriers." And here's another quote, probably a note, as we mentioned in earlier parts of the article. "My heart isn't as dark as it was. There's a glimmer of hope there now. I can get through another week. I know there are a lot of people like me hiding in the dark so no one knows." Future and or additional confirmed little food pantry locations can be found at mapping.littlefreepantry.org. Many other organizations provide free food resources to the Dubuque County area. To find these resources, go to the Feed Dubuque County Facebook page or email jason@dbqfoundation.org. The article is accompanied by a picture of Andy Spaniel, and there is a picture of Chase Spaniel, left 15, and Andy Spaniel, both of Asbury, Iowa, stocking the little food pantry at Lord of Life Lutheran Church on Asbury. And that was taken on Thursday, and the picture is provided by Nikki Cole of the Telegraph Herald. At the lower right of the main front page, University of Wisconsin Platteville students take helm. This is reported by Bennett Goldstein, Cuba City, Wisconsin. Harley Beatty, I'm going to spell that B-A-T-Y, could be Batty. Harley Beatty recently reviewed with her class a lesson about writing, specifically authors' intentions behind their compositions. A writer's aims might be to persuade or to entertain, but Beatty's students at Cuba City Elementary School had lingering questions. How does the author figure it out? Asked third grader Chrissy Dressler. Like, how do they know I'm going to write about this? Her classmate Madison Kirk suggested, because they think of different stuff and sometimes they put it together. I love it, said Beatty, who graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Platteville in December. Usually college students who are earning their teacher's license work under a supervising faculty member. But the COVID-19 pandemic prompted an unusual demand for staff in the Cuba City School District. School administrators hired 4 seniors from University of Wisconsin-Platteville's Education Department to teach across grades 2 through 5. That experience provided students such as Beatty with opportunities not afforded by traditional student teaching. I was able to make relationships with the students that I normally wouldn't have been able to if I had been with another teacher in the classroom, she said. You don't have someone at the tips of your fingers to assist you and give you ideas right away. You have to really trust in yourself to help the students succeed in the moment before you can get advice. Cuba City School administrators said the arrangement with University of Wisconsin-Platteville enabled the elementary school to remain open for face-to-face instruction nearly the entire academic year so far. They created additional classrooms, converting spaces such as the cafeteria and computer lab, so each grade level had 3 classrooms instead of 2, lowering the headcount per room. That enabled teachers to space desks 6 feet apart, reducing the likelihood of coronavirus exposure. When somebody tests positive, we literally walk in with a tape measure, and anyone that falls within that circle, they have to be sent home, Principal Brad Lutz said. We would have been sending a lot more kids home. Although the state has authorized teaching internships for decades, 2020 marked the first year staff from University of Wisconsin-Platteville School of Education engaged area school districts and offered them some of their best students. COVID changed the playing field a little bit, said Jens Collins, director of the School of Education. Schools can't find subs. Would you rather have an intern in there and give a college student a different teaching experience? University of Wisconsin-Platteville is the only institution in the tri-state area to offer a teaching internship program. In addition to Cuba City, the Highland, Mineral Point, Platteville, and Southwestern Wisconsin school districts are using interns who receive a $4,500 stipend while fulfilling the requirements necessary to receive their teaching license. They meet with a faculty member each day to review their progress. I can't imagine myself student teaching like normal and not having my own class, said fifth grade teacher intern Megan Klein. The mentorship has been really great, but at the same time you're able to grow on your own. Although the pandemic has highlighted the immediate benefits of the program, Collins hopes to develop it as a recruitment tool to encourage University of Wisconsin-Platteville students to work in local schools after graduation. I'm hoping this is our baby step toward having that bigger conversation, she said. How do we prepare the best teachers to be in rural communities? The article is accompanied by a couple of pictures of student teacher Harley Beatty in her animated pose. She's wearing a shield in each of the pictures, and she looks very animated as she is instructing her students in a writing class. The daily report on the area COVID rates are, I'll give you the county-by-county positivity rate on a 14-day span. For example, Dubuque County added 39 new COVID-19 positive cases between 5 p.m. Wednesday, 5 p.m. Thursday. So its 14-day positivity rate inched up to 12%. In Delaware County, the county's rate for a 14-day positivity rate rose to 13%. Clayton County, its rate fell to 17%. Jones County, its rate trickled down to 13%. And those are those in the area, basic area, that are making their reports at this time. On the Tri-State page, we have a story by Bennett Goldstein of the Telegraph Herald. Platteville in-school move questioned. Several Platteville school board members are questioning the safety of increasing face-to-face instruction for high school students after the district superintendent announced his decision to move from 2 to 4 in-person days per week. What we have found as we've progressed through one half of the school year is that virtual instruction is a barrier to learning for some of our students, said Superintendent Jim Badal, reflecting on adjustments made because of the COVID-19 pandemic. We are at a juncture where I think we can make an adjustment. Students will attend classes in person on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, while classes will be held virtually on Wednesdays. Students still will have the option to opt for 100% virtual instruction, as has been the case all year. 88 students currently do so. Parents or guardians of high school students will be asked to select their children's preference and have until 11 a.m. Monday, January 18, to decide. The transition is scheduled to occur Monday, January 25th. Students at Neil Wilkins Early Learning Center also will attend classes for an additional half day per week on Wednesdays. Platteville High School reopened in the fall by splitting students into two cohorts, with the halves attending classes on separate days of the week. Bettel acknowledged that eliminating the system reduces students' ability to maintain social distance and increases the potential for quarantines or a school-wide pivot to virtual learning if COVID-19 exposures occur. However, he discouraged tying the decision to expand face-to-face learning to the availability of COVID-19 vaccines. There will not be a time in our school in which everybody is vaccinated because it's not a mandatory thing to do, he said. When will that occur? A state advisory committee charged with prioritizing demographics for vaccination recently recommended that educators be included in the next group. District administrators estimate that about 75% of staff will accept the vaccine. Everyone who wants to get vaccinated is about to get vaccinated, said school board member Vicki Peterson. Simply by having the staff members protected will reduce the ability for the virus to move through the buildings. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services reports that COVID-19 case activity in Grant County remains very high. John Sponsler, a math teacher at Platteville High School, also requested that Bettel delay the switch. Let's not compromise health and safety because a student failed in gym or didn't make it in geometry, he said. We have strategies to deal with falling grades. We do not have strategies to deal with lifelong health issues caused by COVID-19. The school board last year empowered Bettel to make school opening and closure decisions. We know that this is a heavy, heavy burden, board member Colleen McCabe said. This is a heart-wrenching decision, but it's also hard for students who need to be in a physical space with their teachers. Now, looking at the opinion page, we have our view, quick takes. These are short observations made as editorials of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald editorial board. The first is, center care staff should reconsider COVID-19 vaccine. It was disheartening to learn this week that at several area long-term care centers, about half or fewer of the staffers have agreed to be vaccinated against COVID-19. That includes the Dubuque County-run Sunnycrest Manor, where just 46% of workers took the vaccine when given the opportunity, despite the cajoling of the faculty's interim administrator. Education, discussion, and encouragement are about the only tools at the disposal of care center officials when it comes to convincing workers to get vaccinated. Employees at these facilities play a vital role in the healthcare system in jobs that aren't easy to fill. Sunnycrest isn't alone. Luther Manor communities in Dubuque County and Bell Tower Retirement Assisted Living Facility in East Dubuque, Illinois, faced a similar lukewarm response from staffers. The same scenario is playing out in some nursing homes across the country. Employees at those sites generally have expressed concern about the rapid development of the vaccine, even though experts say those fears are unfounded. The position is a stark contrast to the feelings of the patients for which these employees care and the loved ones of those patients, most of whom are eager for the vaccine and a potential reuniting with family. At Sunnycrest, 90 of the 91 residents were signed up for the vaccine. With a death toll at more than 350,000, the top medical experts in the country are leading the effort to get at least 70% to 85% of the U.S. population vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. Here's hoping those who work in our nation's care facilities eventually will understand the importance of their decision to get vaccinated. Those who work in these facilities care deeply for their patients. Getting a vaccine will benefit their patients and the greater good. A second take, it's a telling reality that Resources Unite already has distributed the usual annual budget for Dubuque County General Assistance just halfway into the fiscal year. The $128,000 allocated by the county to help provide rent, utilities, and burial financial assistance has been exhausted with 6 months left. What's more, Resources Unite Executive Director Josh Jasper said the agency has seen 30% more applications in the past 6 months than in all of the past fiscal year. County supervisors are asked to put more money toward general assistance to serve county residents through the rest of the fiscal year. Supervisors need to approve the funding. Yes, the county must be judicious in its spending. Yes, Resources Unite must show a detailed accounting of how taxpayer dollars are spent. But if public money is ever called for to help out our fellow citizens, this is the year. And the third take. In a year when so many local businesses have struggled to remain successful, it's compelling to hear about business stepping up to give back to the community in need. That kind of story played out recently in Alcater, Iowa, when two companies paired up to repair a broken gate on the Turkey River Dam. Sister companies Mobile Track Solutions and C.J. Moyna and Sons, both owned by Alcater resident John P. Moyna, collaborated to complete the repairs. Anyone who has been to Alcater knows the double-arched stone bridge is a landmark in the Clayton County community. Only the floodgates on the dam have not worked for decades, and the city hasn't been able to pay for the expensive repair. Enter the in-house engineering team of Mobile Track Solutions, who designed and manufactured a replacement gate using reinforced steel. C.J. Moyna and Sons installed it over 2 days in December. It's not often that businesses can provide a gift that helps an entire community, but this effort in Alcater did just that. A salute to Mobile Track Solutions and C.J. Moyna of and Sons for a job for a damn well done. And those are the RVU quick takes by the Dubuque Telegraph Herald editorial staff. We have an other view column that is submitted by Arthur Sear, C-Y-R, for the Telegraph Herald, and it mentions that Sear is a Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College. And the title of his submission is Examining Further Significance of Violent Capital Insurrection. The shocking mob violence in Washington, D.C. on January 6 directly challenges the fundamental nature of our governmental institutions, political practices, and the stability of our society. The criminal acts capped weeks of extreme, provocative, incendiary rhetoric from President Donald Trump, denouncing his defeat in the November presidential election as the result of an allegedly rigged, corrupt voting process. There can be no serious doubt that Trump incited the riot. Meanwhile, numerous lawsuits protesting the election loss as a result of the corrupt election process have gone nowhere. Courts have uniformly rejected them. This includes the U.S. Supreme Court as well as numerous state courts. Five people are confirmed dead, including a Capitol Police officer and a woman who was part of the demonstration that turned extremely violent. Mob thugs forced their way into the Capitol building and occupied the Senate chamber. Members of Congress remaining in the House chamber for a time were under direct threat as the mob rampaged through the building before law enforcement forced rioters back outside. The loss of life is tragic. The disruption of the Congress extraordinarily disturbing. However, this violent spectacle is neither unique nor a sign that our government institutions face fundamental threat to their existence. Physical attacks on United States government institutions are not unique. During the War of 1812, British troops in 1814 occupied Washington, D.C., and burned the Capitol along with the White House and other government property. As Professor Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago and many others accurately observe, today public officials, for political reasons, are at times lenient in handling attacks on property and people. Consequently, criminals can shelter in the extremes of the political spectrum. Those seeking political left cover include the thugs who assaulted the Republican Party officials in Washington, D.C. following the National Convention. Violence involving firebombs and shooting a federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, and comparable despicable incidents involving far-right criminals. Despite the mob violence and criminality around the U.S. Capitol, Congress certified the Electoral College vote, confirming the inauguration of former Vice President Joe Biden on schedule as our next president. Vice President Mike Pence announced the vote result in Congress and provided an example of calm leadership, including responsible, sensible statements and decisions. Various people expressed concern Trump might try to use his authority as commander of our armed forces to seize control of government by force or otherwise disrupt or deny the orderly transition to the new Biden administration. For that reason, all living former U.S. defense secretaries have signed and made a public a letter warning Trump not to try to use our military to pursue his complaints about the election result. Civil-military relations are challenging by definition, but have been relatively stable in our own nation's history. Past problems have involved insubordinate military commanders, notably Generals George McClellan and Douglas MacArthur, threatening Presidents Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War and Harry Truman during the Korean War. In each case, the president fired the general. Trump, in fact, is far more partial to talk than action. He has tried, with limited success, to fulfill a campaign pledge to reduce extensive American military engagements around the world. This is one factor in his notable support among rank-and-file military personnel and veterans. There is absolutely no evidence our military at any level would follow illegal orders from soon-to-be former President Donald Trump. That was the column titled Examining Further Significance of Violent Capital Insurrection, submitted by Arthur Sear, is a Clawson Distinguished Professor at Carthage College. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Friday, January 15th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. And on the funeral services list, the very brief notices, listed alphabetically, Tony M. Ames, Dubuque, celebration of life, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Saturday, January 16, the Muller Memorial Chapel, Linwood Cemetery, Dubuque. Holly M. Amundson, Dubuque, visitation 3 to 7 p.m. today and 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, January 16, Bear Funeral Home, Dubuque. Charles L. Bacon, Hopkinton, Iowa, visitation 10 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, January 16, Getch Funeral Home, Monticello, Iowa. Paul F. Behr, B-E-H-R, Dubuque, visitation 9 to 10 a.m. today. Behr Funeral Home, Dubuque, services 10:30 a.m. today, Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Dubuque. Molly M. Kaiser, Piasta, Iowa, Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. today, St. John the Baptist Catholic Church, Piasta. Betty G. LeClaire, Farley, Iowa, burial 2 p.m. today, Hopkinton, Iowa Cemetery. John Schultz, McGregor, Iowa, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, McGregor. Laura K. Parr, P-A-A-R, Dubuque, visitation 9 to 11 a.m. today, Egelhoff, Seeger, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, Dubuque. Services 11 a.m. today at the funeral home. Diane M. Severdine, Dubuque. Visitation 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, January 17. The Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, Dubuque. Dubuque. Services till 10 a.m. Monday, January 18. St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, Dubuque. Edgar J. Turnis, Cascade, visitation noon to 1 p.m. Saturday, January 16. The Rife Funeral Home, Cascade, services 1 p.m. Saturday at the funeral home. Leonard E. Witt, Piasta, Iowa, visitation 9:30 to 10:30 Saturday, January 16, St. Joseph Key West Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. And finally, Carrie W. Zumhoff, Dubuque, visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque. And now we turn to our regular notices. From Lancaster, Iowa, Roberta Jean Krogman, age 92, passed away peacefully with family by her side on Tuesday, January 12th, at Greenway Manor in Spring Green, Wisconsin. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held on Saturday, January 16, at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster, with Father William Vernon officiating, with the burial immediately following at St. Clement Cemetery. Celebration of Jean's life will be held at a later date in lieu of flowers and plants. Please contribute to the Ernest E. Krogman Pat Schroeder Scholarship Fund through the University of Wisconsin Platteville Foundation, University of Wisconsin Platteville, and mention the Ernie and Krogman Pat Schroeder Memorial, Platteville, Wisconsin. Online condolences may be left at Martin Schwartz Funeral Homes and Crematory. That is for Jean Krogman of Lancaster, Wisconsin, who died January 12th at the age of 92. We have John Thomas Kane, died on January 9th in Ashburn, West Virginia, his loving family at his side. John will have a Mass of Christian burial at St. John the Apostle Catholic Church in Leesburg today at 10 a.m. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Missionaries of Charity, Queen of Peace Mission on Wheeler Road, Southeast Washington, D.C., or the American Red Cross. It's for John Thomas Kane of Ashburn, Virginia, who died on January 9th. The from Ridgeway, Wisconsin, Terry L. Faulkner, 70, died on Wednesday, January 13. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, January 21, at Garrity Funeral Home and Chapel. Pray to Sheen. Service will take place at 7 p.m. for Terry L. Faulkner of Ridgeway, Wisconsin. And that concludes the obituaries listed in today's edition. I'm going to go back to the opinion page for the one letter to the editor. This report, it's submitted by Roger Myers, Pasadena Court, Dubuque. Capital siege will be Trump's legacy. After 4 years of lies, insults, vulgarity, false promises, and political division, I thought he had reached his zenith with his unproven and ridiculous claims of a fraudulent election and refusal to concede he had lost. Man, I thought, what more can he do to further degrade the office? Well, we soon found out. On January 6th, he incited a mob which resulted in the forceful invasion of the U.S. Capitol building, the deaths of several people, including a police officer, and the need to call in additional police and National Guard forces to restore order. Even Fox News condemned his actions and his feeble response to the illegal actions he had encouraged. When historians assess President Trump's legacy, this will likely be the hallmark event by which he is most remembered. It was a truly historical event, and President Trump can proudly claim credit for making it happen. Well done, Mr. President. You sure know how to go out with a bang. How sad. That was the only letter today in the Telegraph Herald that was submitted by Roger Myers of Pasadena Court in Dubuque. And now turning to the sports page, we have a couple of prep wrestling stories. The first is reported by Tom Gregory of the Telegraph Herald. Hempstead 61, Senior 9. Mustangs tie up rival Rams in dominant win. Chuck Haas had a pretty good feeling how the night might go. 3 matches into his crosstown battle, the Dubuque Hempstead wrestling coach knew that his premonition was spot on. The host Mustangs won 12 of 14 matches over Dubuque Senior on Thursday at Moody Gymnasium during a 61-6 dual victory, including the first 3 bouts by early pins. Hempstead's Chad Bellis started things right with a convincing win at 132 over Frankie Kretzinger. Bellis nearly pinned Kretzinger in the closing seconds of the first, but settled for 3 back points and finally got the fall with 110 left in the second. Cole Rettenmeyer fell behind seniors Lewis Bunsukan 3-1, but came back with 4 points to take the lead before pinning Busokan with 35 seconds left in the second. Jackson Vanderhaden one-upped them both with a first-period pin over seniors Bo Healy with 45 seconds left in the first. "We came in here thinking we could dominate," Haas said, "and we did. Our guys wrestled real well. Bellis just took care of business, and Rettenmeyer had a pretty even match there, and good to see him get a win. He's been working his tail off." Adam Ward at 220 pounds, Caden Lovett 285, and Dawson Fish 106 later matched Vanderhaden with 3 consecutive first period pins for Hempstead. The first bout to go the distance came at 152, where Hempstead's Ian Ostrander held off Ethan Stockis for a tight 5-1 victory. Jack Smith picked up senior's first win of the night in the 170 match. Smith bested Cole Thill 4-1 in the following match. Another Jack Smith, Hempstead's, won by DQ over Luke Bush. The most exciting and dramatic matches of the night may have been 182 and the duels final later at 113. At 182, Hempstead's Joseph Lewis trailed Ethan Scott 10-7 heading into the third, but came back for the win by fall less than a minute into the final period with a strong leg hold and reversal moves to turn the tide in his direction. Then in the final hookup of the night, Hempstead's Adam Kramer survived a battle Kramer broke a scoreless tie with a two-pointer with less than 30 seconds left in the final period in his showdown with Seth Connolly at 126. Few other matches went the distance, and the ones that did were bold victories for the Mustangs. Jack Hansen notched a 7-1 win over Patrick Ford at 195, and Gable Brooks poured in over Laxon Jackson Rowling for the only major decision of the night, a 14-0 Hempstead win at 120. Seniors Jordan Quinn picked up the other Rams win on the night with a first-period win, pin at 113 over Cody Jellison. "We improved on some things that we didn't do so well the last time out," Haas said. "That's good. It's another step on the road." The article is accompanied by a picture of a couple of wrestlers, Jackson Vanderhaden, working for a pin against Dubuque seniors Bo Healy during their match at Moody Gym on Thursday night. As was mentioned, the Mustangs won that duel 61-6. And another wrestling duel, Western Dubuque 68, Wallert 9, next men in show up. This is reported by Tim O'Neill. Graduation gutted the Western Dubuque wrestling program's starting lineup. The Bobcats call their junior varsity program the next men in for a reason, and they've been showing why this season. Wrestling almost an entirely new starting lineup from last year, Western Dubuque throttled Dubuque Wallert 68-9 on Thursday night at Wallert Gym. "We always work hard in the wrestling room," said Western Dubuque 182-pounder Evan Surface. "We have a lot to prove, and we want to get better every day. That's part of the process at Western Dubuque." Sawyer Nauman is the only returning state qualifier on the roster, and only a handful of other Bobcats have substantial varsity experience after they graduated 9 of 14 starters a year ago. That hasn't stopped them from being competitive, even in losses. Western Dubuque improved to 6-6 in dual meets following Thursday's win, and two of its losses weren't decided until the final match. "That's the nice part about having a program that just reloads year after year. When you get your chance, you've got to take it. Prove who you want to be," Surface said. "You always want to look at what the team needs, not what you necessarily need, but where you can step in for the team to get the mission accomplished." Heavyweight Emerson Lux Morales was behind a state medalist on the depth chart last year. This year he stepped into a starting role for the Bobcats. The key, he says, is working hard in practice every day and not goofing around. "It prepares us for harder matches every day," he said. "If the next men in weren't there, we wouldn't be able to get better every day." The Bobcats put the Golden Eagles into a quick hole Thursday, opening with Mitchell Ashline's pin of John Valdez in 83 seconds at 220 pounds. Lux Morales won by forfeit at 285 for a 12-0 lead before Wallert's Jaron Gill held off Maddox Breeze over the final minute for a 9-8 decision, though Breeze was pushing hard for a match-changing tilt after early erasing a 9-3 deficit over the final 60 seconds. That was the closest the Golden Eagles got to winning the duel, though. Western Dubuque won the next 10 matches and 12 of 14 overall. Caden Molnix at 113 and Alex Ludwig at 120 picked up forfeit victories as the Bobcats surged to 24-3. C.J. Carnmiller won a 5-2 decision over Wallert's Jake Evans at 126, using a third-period tilt to create breathing room near the end of a tight match. Nathan Casey followed with a forfeit win at 132, and Nevin Pins backed that up with a pin of Patrick Ego at 58 seconds at 138. Kyle Schirmer rallied for an 8-5 decision over Diego Meja Moreno at 145, clinching victory for Western Dubuque and pushing the Bobcats' advantage to 39-3 with 5 weights remaining. Dubuque couldn't trim the deficit, though. Logan Massey pinned Jimmy McDermott in 513 at 152, and Dakota Lau stuck Matt Nachtman in 1 minute 5 seconds at 160 pounds, running the Bobcats' winning streak to 9 matches. The Eagles' big highlight came at 170. Gabe Anstrater found himself in a 10-0 hole early in the second period, but reversed Grayson Gardner to his back and finished off the pin in 238. It's a goofy move that he does there, but he's actually been doing that move for 4 years, that very same move. It looks like it was a fluke thing, but we call it the Gabe, Waller coach Joel Allen said. He stayed in the fight. He bled a little bit, but he was confident every time I went over there, even though it was a little lopsided on the scoreboard. Gabe is a kid that's going to give you everything he's got. It's going to be a fight. He's not always going to come out on top, but you know you're going to be in a battle at the very end, and sometimes because he's so athletic, he does stuff like that. Surface won a 13-4 major decision over Dustin Digman at 182 before Nauman closed the duel with a forfeit victory. We've got a lot of guys who are getting their chance, Western Dubuque coach Paul Cleary said. They're seniors and they're making the most of it. The next men in, your junior varsity, is a lot of programs call them, are the most critical part of the program. You have to target and coach everybody in the room, and I'm really proud of our staff because we try to coach all 70 of them as best we can, have a good team atmosphere, and have a lot of fun, because that's what school athletics is supposed to be. And, of course, the article is accompanied by an action picture of two wrestlers. I'm going to read the caption. Western Dubuque's Kyle Shermer wrestles Dubuque Wallert's Diego Meja Moreno during their meet at Wallert's High School on Thursday night. The Bobcats cruise to a 68-9 victory. And we have the local and area roundup of prep sports, and we have Baumhover scores 28 as number 7 Western Dubuque drops Kennedy. It may have been snowy and cold, but inside Western Dubuque High School, Garrett Baumhover was heating up. The Bobcats senior guard was feeling it on Thursday night, lighting up the scoreboard with 28 points behind eight three-pointers. In the Class 3A, number 7 ranked Bobcats toppled Cedar Rapids Kennedy 71-59 in Epworth. We have another score, Darlington 71, Mineral Point 59. In girls basketball, Bellevue has risen to number 10 in the latest Class 2A Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union rankings. As that was released on Thursday, the Comets are 12-1, moved up from the number 13 position. Cascade, now 10-4, rejoined the rankings in Class 2A at number 15, while Maquoketa Valley, 12-0, remained in the top spot. Dubuque Wallert, now at 5-4, dropped to number 13 in the Class 4A poll, down from number 10 last week. Dubuque Senior dropped out of the poll in Class 5A. In prep wrestling, the Cougars go 1-2. At Anamosa, Aiden Noonan at 132 secured a pin and two forfeits, and Ted Weber, 160, earned 2 points and a forfeit at Cascade, went 1-2 at the Anamosa duels by beating North Cedar 72-9, but losing to Anamosa 46-33 and Mid Prairie 43-42. At Tipton, Iowa, Jacob Waller earned a pin and two forfeits to leave Bellevue at the Tipton duels. The Comets lost 3 matches to Wilton, now 72-6. That's the score, 72-6. Monticello 52-24 and Tipton 54-8. At Center Point, Iowa, Wyatt Volker secured a pair of pins at 195 as West Delaware rolled past Cedar Point Urbana 67-10. And held off Don Bosco 36-33. Independence had beat Dyersville Beckman 48-25. Mount Vernon defeated Maquoketa 65-9. In girls prep wrestling, Western Dubuque 18, Dubuque Wallard 18. We go back to the Tri-State page for a John Cruz story. Galena panel denies St. Mary plan. A request to restore a historic school building in Galena and construct additional housing failed to gain traction this week with the city board. Galena Zoning Board of Appeals members did not second a motion to approve a preliminary plan and rezoning request for the property of the former St. Mary School on Elk Street. As a result, the request was denied. The proposal put forth by Economic Growth Corporation and the Galena Foundation sought to restore the building and convert it into 11 one-bedroom affordable housing units. Additionally, the project called for the construction of a two-story, 24-unit apartment building adjacent to the school building on High Street. Parking lots would be developed near the structures. The project was estimated to cost about $11 million. $3 million of that would go toward the restoration of the St. Mary School building. Officials previously stated that the additional apartment building was needed in order to make the project financially feasible. Residents, however, expressed concerns over the project's potential to increase traffic in the neighborhood, cause extensive light pollution, and give rise to limited street parking. "I think there are significant concerns," said April Wagner, Galena resident. "I would be excited about it, except it's Elk Street." This week, representatives of Economic Growth Corporation proposed an updated plan which reduced the total number of apartment units from 35 to 31, along with adding more parking spaces to address concerns from residents. Jim Baranski, an architect working on the project and a Galena Zoning Board member who recused himself from deliberating on the request, added that developers would work with residents on limiting the negative effects of installed lighting. "We would work very hard to make sure we came up with lighting that would be acceptable to everyone," he said. During the public hearing for the proposal, several residents spoke in favor of the project, arguing that it was the best chance to save an important historic structure. "I think anything we can do to save this school at this point, now's the time to do it," said Adam Johnson, Galena resident and local architect. "I can't see how this isn't a win-win for everybody." However, many residents reiterated their opposition. "Still, this is a rather high-density project encroaching on a single-family neighborhood," said Bill Meeker, Galena resident. "I know my neighbors still have concerns about the adequacy of the parking." When the public hearing concluded, zoning board members were hesitant to make a motion. Board member David Jansen made a motion to approve the request, but no other board member seconded it, which resulted in it being rejected. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Friday, January 15th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. anytime. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Irish short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers. from Dubuque. Don Dwyer, creator and curator of the World of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. "I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers," he told me. "I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loris, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library." While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Dwyer, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. "Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training," Don said. He unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. "It's like the Mona Lisa," Mr. Checker said, of his museum. "You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwyer." If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.